It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. If you've been following the news this week, you've probably heard quite a few references to something called fast-track legislation. Fast-track legislation, particularly as it pertains to a free trade deal with Asian nations called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The deal is seen by some as a job killer, especially in the manufacturing sector of Pittsburgh, as well as a threat to the local economy in general. President Obama is asking Congress to delegate to him fast-track authority to put this deal in place. Fast-track was initially created by President Nixon to get around public debate and congressional oversight. But Mayor Peduto and some city council members, among others, are saying not so fast. City Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak is leading an effort to shine some light on this process before a free trade agreement can take hold. She joins us now in our Community Broadcast Center studio. Natalia Rudiak, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me here.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter, at esspgh. Natalia Rudiak, explain the will of council you introduced in the city council chambers this week.
So the will of council that was introduced on Tuesday essentially says that the City Council of Pittsburgh, and I should mention that Mayor Peduto also sent a letter supporting this will of council. It says that we urge Congress to oppose this fast-track legislation, which essentially gives authority for the president to pass what is called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, essentially without any debate or discussion. So we're really talking about two big concepts here, two bills, one of them being fast-track legislation that is currently being discussed in the Senate, in the Senate Finance Committee. And then separately from that, we're talking about this Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. And the fast-track legislation would allow this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, like I said, to go through the U.S. government with hardly any debate. It would limit discussion to the bill, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to 90 days. It would really prevent any amendments to the bill. It's really disconcerting, the secrecy and the lack of debate around the content of what the Trans-Pacific Partnership would be.
And I had a question here. Is it the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal per se, the fast-track process, or both that you have an issue with? Sounds like you do have an issue with both of those things, and that you want to have a discussion. What is it that we need to talk about? What is it that Congress needs to talk about and that the public in general needs to be clued in on?
Well, that's a very, very, very good question, because one of the issues is that we don't know what we don't know. And what I mean by that is that the Trans-Pacific Partnership has essentially been discussed in secret for the past few years by about 600 trade representatives from a few nations. And I should mention that there are actually 12 Pacific Rim nations that are involved in this Trans-Pacific Partnership that represent about 40% of the world's GDP. So what we're talking about is, quote unquote, breaking down boundaries between different countries to allow trade to happen more freely. But the problem with that is that what this does is that it opens the doors to multinational corporations being able to sue countries for what they see as barriers to trade. What does that mean? So it means if a country has rules around everything from environmental regulation to worker protection to public health to anti-smoking laws, that a multinational corporation can come in and sue that country by saying that those laws are a barrier to trade. We can say, well, that sounds unlikely. It's actually happened dozens of times in the past. I would urge listeners to go to the Public Citizen website, where you can actually look at a number of different cases around that. But there have actually been a couple of cases where Philip Morris has sued the countries of Australia and Uruguay for their anti-smoking policies because they say that it's a barrier to their goods being sold in those countries.
Wow. So how does it hurt us here in Pittsburgh?
Well, it hurts us here in Pittsburgh because there's just so much that is being covered in secret. And actually, I should mention that the reason that we know about some of these things is actually through WikiLeaks. There was actually a big portion of the trade agreement that was leaked through WikiLeaks. So again, we don't know what we don't know, but we can really try to deduce what's going to happen through previous trade deals. What we do know is that there has never been enough protection around currency manipulation and around country of origin labels for different products. And that really affects our manufacturing industry here in Pittsburgh. We may have heard that Pittsburgh-based U.S. Steel has actually laid off thousands of U.S. Steel employees over the past just few weeks. What happens, and you start to get really into the complicated echelon of international economics here, and that's why it's sort of, I think, hard to push out to the general public. But a lot of countries like Japan and China will manipulate currencies so their goods are undervalued when they come into the United States, and they'll flood the market with all this cheap steel and all these other cheap manufacturing products. And that essentially leaves factories around here idle, and people literally lose their jobs. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands of jobs being potentially lost. That's what we saw from NAFTA. That's what we saw from CAFTA. That's what we saw with the U.S.-Korea trade deal. And that not only affects the manufacturing jobs themselves, but we've seen, I mean, in towns across Pittsburgh, when we've seen this cheap flooding of foreign products, we've seen everything from the local elementary schools close to the churches closing to the little restaurants on the corner closing. So this has a ripple effect of massive proportions in our local towns and communities. And again, what's scary about this is that we're talking about 21 countries that represent 40% of the country's GDP. So it's sort of like NAFTA on steroids.
And I heard you mention NAFTA. You've mentioned NAFTA a couple of times here,
yeah.
And we've heard the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal of not just here on this program just now, but others compare this to NAFTA, which most people see as something that hurt American workers and that it was a mistake over 20 years ago when President Clinton pushed that through. Why is President Obama doing this? I mean, you know, it's a Democrats like
right.
yourself who are opposing
right.
this, but the president is a Democrat. It's a Republican-controlled Congress, but he wants to just railroad this through Congress, and the question is why.
Well, that's a really good question. I think what's really interesting about this whole process is that you're actually seeing a unification of folks on the right and folks on the left across the spectrum that are fighting against this secret process. So you'll have organizations like the Cato Institute, which leans right, and the Economic Policy Institute, which leans left, all against this. And then you have this odd fellows combination where you have President Obama working with Senate Republicans on this bill, on these bills, I should say, and then you have Senate Democrats that are working against it. So it's a good question. There are, as you can imagine, a lot of corporate lobbyists that are really making the case for this because, you know, at the end of the day, it's a good deal for multinational corporations when you could come in and tell a country what you'd like to see to better sell your products, and you could essentially usurp local and national laws to make that happen.
How do you see the deal then affecting workplace and environmental regulations?
That's a really good question. So, again, I keep going back to what we're calling, what is actually technically called investor-state dispute settlements, which is the system that allows countries to, or allows corporations to go in and sue countries for what they see as not working for them. So there, like I said, there have been dozens of cases of this. There was a few years ago a case where a company actually sued the state of California because the state had banned a toxic fuel additive. And the corporation said that that was a barrier to trade. We see that also the same case happen in Canada. Like I said, there's actually a website called Public Citizen where you can download about, gosh, two or three dozen of these cases. And I was shocked to uncover some of these things. We have corporations, you know, suing countries like Ecuador and Peru because they have standards against polluting in the Amazon. And these companies are saying that it's a barrier to trade.
We're talking with Pittsburgh City Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak about the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal and the fast-track process that the White House is trying to use to push it through. There are a number of people here in the Pittsburgh area, including Mayor Perduto, some members of council, including Natalia Rudiak, and members of the Pennsylvania congressional delegation, including Senator Bob Casey, who are very much opposed to this, want to slow this down, shed some sunlight on the process, and let people have their say about whether they think this is a good thing for America, and in particular this region, or not. One of the things, Councilwoman, that one of the counterpoints that someone might bring up, so for the sake of being devil's advocate here, yeah. some might say that without the fast track process, clearly you've spelled out why you think people should be opposed to the deal. As far as the process, some might say, particularly President Obama at this point, that we'd never get any trade deals done without this process. So how can we afford to slow things down in this way?
Well, I mean, President Obama essentially brings up why these deals are should be scrutinized the way that they are. You'll see advocates against these deals essentially saying that, well, obviously, if the public knew that, states and countries could be sued for these things, the public would never approve them. And it's really incredible to me that we actually have our Congress that is ceding its authority to the secret cabal of trade representatives that are rewriting the rules for governance in our country.
As far as you're concerned, is this a constitutional issue in the sense that the congressional checks and balances that are supposed to be in place are being moved out of the way?
Yeah, that absolutely concerns me. This legislation, literally the fast track legislation, I should say, literally has provisions in it that limit debate, limit amendments, and say that the Trans-Pacific Partnership legislation needs to be passed within 90 days. I should also actually say that the fast track legislation not only applies to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but would apply to all trade deals that would be done through 2018 with a trigger that would just allow the deals to go through 2021. So essentially, we're allowing Congress would be ceding its authority on trade deals for the next 6 years.
So you're acting as a member of council on behalf of the interests of your constituents. Are the points being heard? Is what you did in council this week getting some notice from Washington?
Well, I think it's getting some traction across the country. We're actually joining with a number of other cities and states that are doing that, or that are passing these wills of council. I know Seattle just did a similar will of council, which is pretty interesting when you consider that Seattle is a port city and many of its congressional representatives may be supportive of this. I should mention that there's about 151 congressional representatives that are against this. Of course, we'd like to raise that number. And it's good to see some Pennsylvania legislators against this, but we need to get more. We really need to get all of our congressional delegation on board to say, you know what, why are you ceding your power and authority to this? We need to do more.
Pittsburgh City Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and fast-track legislation. Councilwoman Rudiak, good to have you back with us. Thank you so much for joining us today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Coming up, an interview with one of Pittsburgh's most accomplished rock and rollers, the legendary Lou Christie, when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today, one of the most accomplished singer-songwriters to hail from the Steel City, Lou Christie, will become the first artist to be inducted as a Pittsburgh rock and roll legend. Between 1963 and 1973, he not only charted a dozen top 100 hits, he did so in a variety of styles, ranging from doo-wop to country, including a gold record that went to number one, Lightning Strikes. Now 72, Lou Christie still does about 50 shows a year and is in fact performing in Palm Springs tonight, which is preventing him from being in Pittsburgh for the induction ceremony. But he joins us now by phone. Lou Christie, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Essentially my hometown.
Right. Well, first of all, what does it mean to you to be inducted as a Pittsburgh rock and roll legend?
Well, you know what? I was just thinking about that. I thought, now, what does that really mean? You know, because I was just out there doing my job and doing what I wanted to do. You know, this was my passion growing up outside of Pittsburgh there in a little town called Glen Willard or around Coriopolis and or Moon Township. You know, I always wanted to do this. I just, from the time my mom played the Peggy Lee records, the 78 records, and Bing Crosby and television came into fashion, I mean, this is what I have to do. I wasn't going to work in the steel mill like my father, you know, or work on a farm like he had 109 acres that we constantly dug up and put tomatoes in and other things. But what it means to me is, like, I don't know. It's something that I've really wanted my whole life, as to be a singer, and to end up with this kind of as I get older, I'm acquiring many more things like this, and I think, geez, I don't know. That music must have really hit people, and thank God I'm still working out there. So I guess if I'm still doing my job out there working, I guess I get to receive a lot of accolades.
As you mentioned, you grew up just outside of Pittsburgh, so you weren't right in the city, which makes me wonder how you got discovered. Who found you out there in Moon Township and said, we've got to get this guy into a recording studio? How did it all happen?
You know, people ask that question. I don't think that's ever the way it happens. No one discovered me. I discovered myself running around the farm and feeding the chickens and everything, singing all the time. And like I said, I saw television and radio and listened to radio, and I still like radio better than television today. But I wanted to be a singer. I just felt I had to follow that musicality that I had. And I ended up figuring out how to get into Pittsburgh because, you know, when you're young and living out in a farm, the biggest thing you do at Christmas time is to go see Santa Claus at Horns or Gimbel's or wherever he was at that time. So going to Pittsburgh was like, you know, me traveling right now back to Paris or something or Rome, because it was so far away. It was about 35 miles away, you know. And I knew there was a record company there. I was very aware of a group called the Skyliners. And as I was, you know, listening to their music, they said, you know, I heard them say Pittsburgh Skyliners. And I thought, oh, my gosh, if they can make a record here, so can I. And so I just, I had the record and I, took the names and I said it to Pittsburgh Calico Records and Lenny Martin and all these names, and I started contacting them, and little by little I somehow ended up having someone say, well, I'll put up the $300 or something to put you into the studio, and one thing led to another, and I was singing background for Marcy Joe, a record called Ronnie Come Back, which was the first time I sang on a record background. And then all of a sudden, the first record that they let me step up to the microphone and be the lead was The Gypsy Cried. And that was the first record I wrote with my partner, Twyla.
I had some trouble with my baby, so I had my fortune read.
And wrote it in about 15 minutes and recorded the record, and it became my first million-selling record.
The Gypsy Cried.
And you ended up working for the infamous Morris Levy, who ran Roulette Records in New York, and this guy, Morris Levy, was the inspiration for the Sopranos character, Hesh.
And more than that.
A legendary character. Tommy James wrote about him in his book about the Shondells. How would you describe Morris Levy, Lou?
Well, Morris was, first of all, Tommy's book was really great. I loved it. It seemed to be a chapter out of mine. The typical, usual, you know, Svengali that would control everything, and that's what he did. He had a lot of charisma, the man, but I personally didn't make the deal because it was made through Pittsburgh, a man called Nick Sensi and Herbie Cohen. They owned the little label that I recorded for, and that was out of Pittsburgh, and they were a distributing firm, and they distributed Morris Levy's records, Roulette, and they ended up doing a deal with them. I had no idea what the deal was, and I still don't. That was my recollection of Morris, and I was with him until I turned 21, because I thought, geez, maybe I should be getting some money for this. And that was the joke, and I'm still saying the same thing after 50-some years. So.
Well, at least you got away from him because there was the mob influence, and you know, guys like Morris Levy had a lot of control over artists, which included basically taking the money away from the guys that were singing the songs and making the hits and putting that money in their own pockets.
Well, that's what they did, you know. And, you know, I had to sort of let it go. I said, well, I'm leaving. That's it. So I just signed with another label and moved on. And I was 21 at that point after The Gypsy Cried and Two Faces Have I and How Many Teardrops and an album. And after maybe 20-some years of cutting hit records, I think Morris ended up with all of my masters at the end of my whole, you know, a 20-year run of hit records. He just had his paws or fingers or whatever you want to call it into everyone's office and everyone's position in the record business. It was quite amazing to see how he ended up with all of my masters.
And so how did that ultimately impact you, Lou?
It's called starting over. I had to pick myself up, and I traveled a lot, you know, in those early days and doing concerts and doing all this writing. So I was always preparing myself because I thought I have to think about the next record, you know. But to start over again, I started over a few times in my career. And I think the first time I probably thought it was going to be the hardest, but I think after that it even turned a little harder. And so, you know, but I feel good about it today because it's where I am right now, and I guess I had to learn a lot of things before you end up where you're supposed to be at.
We're talking with Lou Christie, who is being inducted as a Pittsburgh rock and roll legend in a ceremony today. He's speaking to us by phone. And so, Lou, are you sitting by a piano right now?
A little bit. Out of tune. Terrible.
Magnificent.
I'm really not a good piano player at all. No, it's not my... I hear it all. I hear the whole orchestra in my head, you know, and that's how I do... when I write melodies, I sort of do them when I'm walking around, and, you know, I still walk around with a little tape recorder and sing all these melodies, and I can, you know, and then I find the chords after when I come home, and I can modulate, and I hear the drums, and I hear the bass players and the horn lines and strings. So it's like, really, that's why you get a little disturbed after a while. Yeah, that's how I've always done it. It's amazing because I remember when I started writing The Gypsy Cried, I said, cry, yeah, 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 yeah. I heard, and then I heard the double harmony. And I said, we got to get to the piano. I got it. You know, and that was the beginning. That was the very first record I wrote with Twyla.
Lou, your first experience on the road was playing what was called the Chitlin' Circuit down south, where you traveled with black artists. And this was in the early 60s during the civil rights turmoil. What was that like?
Oh, my gosh. Well, as I look back and look at those films that are being played today, being from Pittsburgh, I had no idea what this was going on in the South, you know, because people in Pittsburgh just didn't have that mentality. But when we went into the South with the Dick Clark Caravan, it was just quite unbelievable because I'm sitting on the bus with Diana Ross when she was with the Supremes and the Crystals and Bo Diddley and all the drifters and the coasters and Barbara Lewis. And, you know, we had an international tour that we were on. Maybe 10 acts were on the show. And we all jumped on a bus with one band, and we all had hit records. And we traveled all through the South, through Savannah, Georgia, through, you know, Greensboro, North Carolina, Alabama, Birmingham, Montgomery. And this, they wouldn't allow us in some of the places to stop and get food. They just wouldn't allow us because the bus was black. I thought it was like a freedom bus, and they would throw rocks at us. I mean, they tried to knock over the thing, and we've had, you know, people shooting at us, and it was really something. But the show would not go on. Dick, we all just said, this is crazy. You know, we're not going. And they would say, well, you can't go on because the white artists couldn't go on because the band was black, or the black artists can't go on because, you know, but we said the show goes on at 8 o'clock. If you want it, you know, it's there. And we just broke every barrier and continued on up the road and did that for 32 one-nighters in a row, about three times in my first couple of years. So, and I remember doing 72 one-nighters in that same situation. It was quite scary, especially when we hit that South. It was unbelievable. And I remember sleeping outside. We couldn't get into the hotel in Baltimore, Maryland. And all of us, though, many of us slept out in the, you know, out in the grass right outside the bus in front of the hotel. A lot of trouble, but we got through it.
You had a chart-topping hit, Lightning Strikes, which went to number one during the height of the British invasion. Explain how that happened.
Well, I wrote it, and I thought I need another hit record. And, you know, it's so funny because I didn't try, and I never wanted to try, and I still don't want to try to make records like anyone else. I found the creativity was, you know, that journey of coming up with something original, much more exciting than trying to sound like someone else. And when we wrote Lightning Strike, which we wrote in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania, by the way, I think we really knew we had a really big monster hit. Twyla and I wrote the record. We went back Monday. We had to show up, but in the office here in New York, and working with a gentleman by the name of Charlie Colello, and went into the studio and cut four great, great songs and, you know, wrote them all. And it was released on MGM, but they didn't even like the record when I took them the record. You know, Charlie and I went over with my manager and we played the record for them because they were signing me and I had already had a couple million selling records. So they were very excited at that time to sign me. But they didn't like the record. I mean, the guy who was the president of the company, Lenny Shear, he threw the record in the garbage. He said, this is a piece of crap, you know. But it was so funny because about 4 months later, he was taking a picture with me for the front cover of Billboard magazine and presenting me with the gold record. So.
And it had your signature falsetto, and it was filled with sexual tension, which you didn't find in a lot of pop music hits at that time, did you?
No. And I think my follow-up was even more controversial because that was called Rhapsody in the Rain. And that was about, and I used the phrase, like most of the young people we talked about, we were making out in the rain. And, you know, when you made out, you know, if you remember back to that period, I wrote about, and the windshield wipers seemed to say, together, 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 together. Yeah, so it was like a rhythm of this sexual thing that was going on in the car. And they said, oh, no. So they started banning it around the country. And they made me go in and change the lyrics to it and so-called clean them up a little. And so we re-released the record again only a couple weeks after they had me, you know, get off the road and go in there and change the lyrics to it. And but there were, I think, I forget how many thousands that were, 50,000 or 25,000 of the original dirty version.
The windshield wipers seem to say, together, 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 together. And now they are saying, together, oh, never, never, go away, go away, baby. Rhapsody in the rain,
and that's the one that's worth a lot more money because of the original lyrics to it. But it still, it climbed up the charts in the top 10, and that was another million seller, you know, for me. So I was very pleased with that one.
And you ended up getting to invade England yourself. And here you are writing these songs that, you know, during the British invasion, you're competing with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and groups like that. Oh. But you end up going to England and appearing on the TV shows over there, the legendary shows like Top of the Pops and Ready, Steady, Go. So how did it feel to strike a blow for America?
I felt great about it, but the most interesting thing about it, I think a lot of people, when the English invasion came out, many of my friends who were, I was on the Dick Clark bus with, you know, didn't have hit records anymore. There weren't the people like, you know, Bobby Rydell hadn't had a big record at the time, or Fabian or Frankie Avalon. I mean, because they would, you know, a lot of people who had those hit records had a different look. You know, they had that sort of good looking Italian kind of look. And, but this was a different whole scenario when the English came over, because they had the long hair and they had sort of wise little answers when they had, you know, were interviewed. And the records were totally different, but I ended up writing this record and having this arrangement that just was its own life. And everyone started thinking that I was English then. Even like some of the fans from America, they thought, no, he's English, because England had taken over then so much. Because then I started appearing with people like The Who, The Animals, you know, Dave Clark Five, all the English people I was then put on the road with and did concerts with all over America and in England. So I started going over to England and doing the TV shows over there. And I did a couple Royal Command performances. It was wonderful. I had a wonderful time. And at the same time, I was still looking for my money from the Gypsy Cride, you know, hiring attorneys to still try to find my money.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Lou Christie, who will become the first artist to be inducted as a Pittsburgh rock and roll legend today. He speaks with us by phone. And as I mentioned at the outset, you're still touring, still performing, and still churning out songs, still recording. And you have a new song, and it's called Drive-In Dreams?
Yes.
I'm
so excited about it. I feel like I'm back to being 17 again, you know, and I feel so good about the record, and we're getting such great response. And of course, you know, technology has changed the world. And so we're trying to follow through with wherever we can get this record played. And it's starting to really show up already, and people really love the record. So I couldn't be more happier.
Lou Christie is being inducted today as a Pittsburgh rock and roll legend. He's still touring, and he has, as you heard, the brand new song that he has been in the studio tweaking called Drive-In Dreams. Lou Christie, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
When the Fox Chapel girls come around on a Saturday night, driving dreams at night still carry on. The endless nights, the broken hearts, the girls we left behind in those driving dreams.
Pittsburgh has a rich musical legacy, from its symphony orchestra to its distinguished jazz history, from Billy Strayhorn to Billy Eckstein. The city has been the birthplace of musical legends. Wiz Khalifa, Rusted Root, and the Clarks have found national recognition. Yet New York and L.A. have long been considered the launching points for aspiring artists. Does Pittsburgh's music scene provide a springboard for musicians to become successful on a national stage? Dana Canoni is a record producer and owner of the Church Recording Studio in Carrick. After touring with various artists around the United States, Dana has returned to Pittsburgh to help foster the careers of local musicians. Dana shares his view on what the industry offers to musicians today.
I mean, I think it's really smart for bands to be from a place like Pittsburgh to take advantage of our forgiving economy. And, you know, there's a big enough community where you can get any kind of work done at any professional level that is needed.
In the 1950s, Gateway Records was one of the few recording studios in Pittsburgh. Among the artists who recorded here are jazz legend Louis Armstrong and the rock and roll group Buddy Sharp and the Shakers. Today, there are over 20 recording and production studios in the city, specializing in a multitude of music genres. Grammy Award-winning drummer and producer Charles Pooji Bell has worked with many artists, including David Bowie, Roberta Flack, and Chaka Khan. Based on his experiences, Pooji has a different opinion on how the Steel City's music industry compares to other cities.
Pittsburgh is a secondary or thirdary market. No one is coming to discover you. That's not going to happen. I don't care how talented you are. If you want to be in a game, you have to go where the game is. You have to go to New York. You have to go to Los Angeles. You have to go to Atlanta. You have to go to Nashville. You have to go where the real big boys are playing the game and find out what your skill set is and what it has to offer. There are too many really good musicians here who just don't leave. And they don't leave because the cost of living is so low and on all the things that Pittsburgh is, which is great, but it's a double-edged sword. Each side is very, very sharp. So I just wish more of them would go out, especially while they're young people, go out and see. You know, if you're doing this and you know what this is, you can always come back and do this. But if you don't go, you're not going to know.
The hit single, Send Me On My Way, is the signature tune for the Pittsburgh-based band Rusted Root. Liz Berlin, lead vocalist of Rusted Root and co-owner of Mr. Small's Theater, opens up about perceptions of local artists.
There's sort of this perception that if you're from Pittsburgh, you're sort of local and you're just from Pittsburgh. But if you go to New York City and then you come back, you're like, oh, fresh from New York City. Like, there's more value to that for some reason. And I think that's been one of the downfalls of Pittsburgh and how Pittsburgh has maybe not embraced its local talent as much as we could. Now, that said, it is definitely valuable to go to other cities and to play.
With over 1 million online downloads and over 100,000 Twitter followers, Pittsburgh native hip-hop artist, activist, and entrepreneur Kelly Mays has made a fan base here and beyond the city limits. As a rising artist, Kelly shares her views on where success can be found.
I guess some people think that, you know, New York, L.A., whatever, you get discovered. I suppose that's maybe more likely in places like that than it would ever be in Pittsburgh. But I personally still think, I mean, I know a lot of people in L.A. who've been hustling for ever. In New York, same thing. So it's not, I don't necessarily think we have it any worse.
Success, whether it's in music or other fields, means something different for everyone. For some, success as a musician could mean performing small gigs in your hometown. For others, it can be worldwide fame. As they reflect on their careers, Kelly Mays and Liz Berlin give us insight on their interpretation of success.
I don't really value the same things maybe that everybody else does, so it's hard to speak to, like, success. You know, like, some people see money as success, some people see touring as success, some people, you know, so it depends on your what is it that matters to you.
There are so many different types of success and so many different levels of success. I feel that Rusted Root's been extremely successful. Obviously, you know, with our first hit, Send Me On My Way, and our first kind of rise to stardom was really just like a fairy tale story that for Pittsburgh. And we feel very successful about that. And that song was featured in a lot of movies for children like Matilda and like Ice Age. And because of that, our fan base kind of turns over every single generation. It just recycles. And we have like this never ending cycle of young fans. So the ages of our fans are from, you know, 3 to 90. And that never ends for us. And that's success. That's wonderful.
Whether they've hit it big on the national stage or they're working local venues, Pittsburgh musicians represent a variety of styles and genres reflecting the city's eclectic tastes. The Steel City sound does have something for everyone. The piece you just heard was produced with help from Nicole Abbott. More Essential Pittsburgh coming up after the break. You're listening to 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Are you planning on spending some time at the beach this summer? If so, contributor Elaine LeBlanc, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town, says now is the time to book that beach destination. And on a day like today, that sounds mighty good. Elaine, welcome back. How are you?
Well, it just turned from spring to winter overnight, and you're right. I am ready for summer and ready for a beach.
Yes, I'm sure many people listening to this are. So, New Girl, although spring has just sprung, we're still not feeling those warm temperatures. You're telling us that even though we're not even into May yet, that it is now time to plan the summer beach vacation, stat.
Yeah, and the thing is, we're not the only ones having this bright idea. A lot of people are thinking along these lines, and you know, there are a couple of beach vacations we try to take every summer, and I set them up last month. I try to do it before spring comes around and people start, you know, getting that itch to go to the beach. It's not too late yet, but certainly the better prices, obviously, on airfares and hotels go fast. And once, you know, spring breaks and people are just starting to think, you know, it's going to be summer. The kids will be out of school soon. Everybody just jumps in. And, you know, a lot of things will sell out quickly. So if you want the best price and you want to have options, you got to do it now.
East Coast, West Coast, or Southern U.S.? Where are we likely to find the best deal?
Well, yeah, I think what happens is that the destinations that are popular, that are well-known, seem to continue to get more popular. There's disposable income. People are traveling. Gas prices are down, so people are driving. You know, they won't hesitate to drive to some of the East Coast beaches, certainly, and even
so
some.
So people are less inclined, I'm sorry to interrupt you, people are less inclined to do the staycation thing or do something that's, well, we'll go somewhere close.
What I'm certainly hearing is that people are willing to drive and go a little bit farther afield. Now, a lot of people with respect to beaches are still thinking East Coast and Southern U.S., and I think that you shouldn't discount California. A lot of people would like to go to California, but California pricing has definitely gotten up there. It's high. So if you want to do something on the West Coast, certainly you'd want to book as soon as possible. I'd also suggest to people that they consider beaches in Oregon. They're so beautiful, especially if you are going to go in July and August. It's warm enough, you know, rocky coastline. You may not be swimming as you do in the Atlantic, but it's just beautiful beaches out that way. You can save a little bit of money that way. The other thing you want to do on the East Coast, you know, everybody has their favorite beach, of course, and you like to go back to it year after year. But if you're willing to explore something that's a little bit less known, a little bit smaller. So think of the beaches, say, on the Delmarva Peninsula, lesser known beaches in Delaware, maybe a Fenwick Island or a Dewey Beach. Or you go into Virginia, maybe Cape Charles instead of Virginia Beach, say. You're going to get better deals, and you're going to find some, you know, some less crowded beaches as well.
You are a big fan of the Gulf Coast. Tell us about some beaches there that you like.
Okay, when you think of the Gulf Coast, you know, there's a lot of Florida beaches along the Gulf and all the way into Alabama. So you look at the Florida beaches and you can think on an Anna Maria Island beach just south of St. Petersburg. And you should also think of some of the beaches on the Panhandle. It seems that Panama City gets all the press and you hear about all the stories with spring break and problems and whatnot. But there are a lot of beaches on the Florida Panhandle, the Gulf Coast, that are absolutely beautiful, white sand beaches, Pensacola Beach, Fort Walton Beach, both come to mind. I've spent time at both and love them. And then going on a little farther into Alabama, there's a beach like, say, an Orange Beach, not far from Gulf Shores, Alabama. Beautiful white sands, not crowded, not busy. These are places that, I mean, if you decide you want to drive, you can get there in a day and a half's drive. And that makes for a very reasonable week at the beach.
We're talking with Elaine LeBlanc, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town. She is our travel contributor. And sticking with lesser-known beaches, I love the lesser-known beaches. You favor the area north of Boston, extending into Maine.
Now, tell me, I mean, how often are people thinking beach vacation, go north of Boston, especially after Boston got 100 inches of snow? Probably the last thing you're thinking is you're going to sit on a nice warm beach, right?
Well, Newport in relation to Boston is south of
Newport, Rhode Island would be south. But then if you go north of Boston, think of Cape Ann. Think of the beaches like along Gloucester, Good Harbor Beach. It's an oldie but goodie. That's a great beach. Lots of B&Bs in Gloucester. You can go to Front Beach in Rockport. Fried clams in Essex, Mass.
Oh, you know what?
Oh man,
you know what you're making me think of is there's Revere Beach.
Oh,
in
Revere.
Have you ever been there?
Revere Beach. Yes.
It's kind of a joke. It's nothing but rocks. It's nothing but rocks. Great fried clams, but it's so rocky. You know how the Germans used to spy off the coast during World War II? They turned back after they saw that beach. They said, "This is impossible."
Wouldn't surprise me, which is why I'm going to say don't go south of Boston. Right. Not quite the same thing. Go north. And if you continue, so again, the Cape Ann beaches are maybe an hour north of Boston. You fly in there, you're there in no time. You go another half an hour up the road on I-95, and you're in Kittery, Maine, which is a sweet little town. It's before you get to Kennebunkport. You get into Kennebunkport, everything's going to cost you five times as much. If you go to Kittery, Maine, that's a beautiful rocky beach that'll still be lovely in July and August. Not terribly expensive community. That's a great place to go.
Many of us in the region have grown up spending summers in places like Stone Harbor or the Outer Banks. Are they still worth a visit?
You know, I would say yes. And that certainly the heartstrings and the sentimentality will get people going back to their favorite beaches. What you have to realize, though, is that those communities have certainly grown in popularity. They're going to be a lot more crowded. Maybe it is time to consider a new beach. But, I mean, if you want to go back to Stone Harbor, you know, lots of things to do. Beautiful area. Of course, it's on this 7 Mile Island, so the growth is somewhat constricted there. It won't be quite as explosive, say, as on the Outer Banks. And I have taken those roads on the Outer Banks in the summer just a couple years ago. I mean, the traffic is bumper to bumper. You may spend more time in your car than on the beach. What I would suggest is go very early summer or go after Labor Day. And you still have to plan those visits now.
Sure.
Because it's a popular destination. But try to avoid that, you know, mid-June to late August crunch. That's just going to take a little bit of the charm, I think, out of the Outer Banks.
Lastly, give us your go-to spot, for couples and maybe another one for families. So, you know, you want to get away from it all, you know, and romance, the couples thing, that spot, and then, you know, bring in all the kids, that spot.
There you go. And you know what I think I'll do is I'll send you to Florida for both. There is a little boutique hotel in Key West called the Marquesa. And actually, this property is only 14 and above. You can bring big kids. I've had the great good fortune of being there twice. I have never seen a kid there. And some of those old conch houses on Key West, what they did is they took four of them that are situated now around this gorgeous, gorgeous courtyard with a couple of pools. There's an award-winning restaurant there, Cafe Marques. There's maybe 14, 15 rooms on the property. This is so secluded, so quiet, so romantic. In the middle of Key West, the way they make it happen is unbelievable. But then you've got the ability to, you know, find a lot of quiet, private beaches, romantic, in the Florida Keys. There are some very, you know, undeveloped and untrafficked beaches in the Keys. For families, I would say a place like the Watercolor Inn in Santa Rosa Beach, which is also on the Florida Panhandle. This is a great, you know, resort property. I mean, you can do 1,001 things there, it seems. You can canoe, you can boat. They've got, you know, family activities, the fire pit, on and on and on. If you just go to that website for Watercolor Inn in Santa Rosa Beach, you're going to want to be there now.
I want to be there now, really. but I've enjoyed being here with you now. Elaine LaBalme, who is our travel contributor. Thanks so much, Elaine. We appreciate it, as always.
Absolutely.
Tomorrow on the program, legendary Pirates pitcher and broadcaster Kent Tekulve talks about bouncing back from health challenges and his illustrious career. And also, we'll tell you about the StoryCorps app. That's tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.